morning, everyone. I'd like to call this remote hearing of the Legacy Committee to order. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today, and hopefully you're safe and warm. So, Katie, good morning. Appreciate it if you could help us out with a roll call this morning, please.
Good morning, everyone. Chair Lilly.
Here.
Vice Chair Jordan?
Here.
Representative Green?
Here.
Representative Acomb?
Here.
Representative Anderson?
Anderson present.
Representative Bowe?
Here.
Representative Christensen?
Present.
Representative Hassan?
Hassan is present.
Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Erdahl.
I'm here, ready to go.
Representative Wagluwek.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Good to go.
Thank you. We have a quorum. So Representative Jordan, have you an opportunity to peek at the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes from February 3rd.
Thank you. Any questions regards to the minutes from our February 3rd meeting? I don't see any hands or waving hands. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails, and thank you, Representative Jordan. So, good morning, everyone. I'm really excited about today's meeting. This is a great opportunity to have some discussion in our funds. You know, it's amazing all the good work. You know, every day I'm struck by, you know, I'll see something out in. You know, just recently I was walking through the airport and I see a piece of artwork or a collection that's being shown and it's paid for, or there's a grant provided by Legacy Money, or, you know, you might be on a trail and then you just happen to see, oh man, this is Legacy, or, but we're in this great place where there's so many opportunities, and a lot of them, quite honestly, are just like revealed to me almost every day. Even having been on this committee since the beginning, it's just like, oh wow, I didn't know we did that, or you know, so there's things like that, but there's also things that we might be missing. So that's kind of what this morning's about, is just to kind of take an opportunity to see how we're doing. You know, the world is you know, we're so blessed by the melting pot that is Minnesota, and the diversity that we're all enjoying. You know, many of us kind of boarding Scandinavians or mutts like I am, you know, you joke about the food, but man, the food, you know, what a great place. And, you know, so we want that in all our, the same thing to carry forward in what we're doing with, you know, bringing the story of everyone to Minnesota. So we want to talk about diversity and inclusion today. So I'm actually really excited about this, and we're going to hear some work that's going on, and maybe there's some holes that we can do a better job. And so I think this is a great opportunity to do good work and to serve Minnesota even better into the future. So that's how I go into this and looking forward. And so we've invited, you know, people from each of the funds to kind of tell their story, and then we're going to leave a ton of time at the end. So please stick around. We're going to have questions at the end, and then members can ask questions. You know, with the Zoom world, I've been guilty myself. We kind of have pushed the meetings full of testifiers because we do have so many stories to tell, but we've kind of left the window at the end, you know, especially today, to have opportunities for questions. So please stick around, and that's how we're going to handle it. We're going to start off with the Parks and Trails Fund, and, you know, the one other thing I want to mention is, too, we're going to hear from people when they bring their bills forward. So yesterday I met with, you know, the people that get our kids out there learning how to canoe and get on the water. The, you know, so, and and they're doing some great work. So we're going to hear other groups as we hear their bills, you know, through sessions. So anyways, but today we're starting kind of generally, and I expect these questions to go on through the entire session. So, but so today in the Parks and Trails area, and I think Renee, are you, Ms. Madsen, are you kicking off?
I am not. I'm second. Lisa will be kicking off.
Okay. Ms. Barras, please go ahead when you're ready and begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas, the Community Development Director at the Metropolitan Council, and truly is my pleasure to be in front of you today with my colleagues, Renee Madsen and Erica Rivers from the DNR. We're really excited to talk to you about all of the work that our respective agencies have been doing to further equitable access and create inclusive spaces within our park systems across the state of Minnesota. So truly thank you for the opportunity. So today we're going to share how the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund helps advance equity in our region and in the state. This is a topic that we are very passionate about, and you'll hear that passion reflected in all of our voices. Like our conversation last week, we could talk all day about this. It's what we do, and we're happy to take questions later. But in the spirit of time, we'll keep things moving. And we'll each take a turn presenting and giving some highlights of our work in each of our agencies, which is by no means reflective of the broad array of work that we're doing, but is just really dipping our toe in it. The Legacy Fund has truly been a game changer for the Metropolitan Regional Park System, for the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails, as well as the State Parks and Trails. It provides supplemental funding above and beyond our traditional sources, allowing us to strive to create a world-class system of parks and trails that play a significant role in the lives of all Minnesotans. You're going to hear some themes among us today about our philosophy to this work, how Legacy has helped us go further, and how our work is still it's truly centered around the pillars that are outlined in the 25-year plan for Legacy. This past week, we shared stories with the committee and how the pandemic is impacting our collective systems. As you learned, one of the silver linings is that we're all seeing significant increases in participation, with so many new visitors being introduced to our system, which is great news. The challenge is keeping those visitors coming back, right? Are our spaces inclusive enough for them? Are they welcoming? Are they spaces that all of our Minnesotans across the state feel like are for them, that they can recreate in as well? The pandemic only reinforces our commitment to better serve our new visitors, improving our welcoming services as well as our parks and trail signage, doing more equitable programming and planning with the goal of helping new visitors feel welcome and keep coming back. We place special emphasis on underrepresented communities to make sure they feel that they belong at our parks and trails. So I'd like to highlight just two brief examples of how Legacy Funds are working to create more equitable parks and trails in the Metropolitan Regional Park System. Excuse me. The first is with the City of St. Paul, where they are using Legacy Funds to create a collaborative planning process with Indigenous communities focused on the Dakota burial site or cemetery that is known today as the Indian Mounds Regional Park. Their work is guided by Dakota representatives and their communities. The new plan will be presented to the public, neighbors, and current park users to increase understanding and awareness of the significance of this space, to find common ground for its proper use and care. We hope this work will serve as a model for future engagement processes, creating a role for Indigenous communities in decision making, especially because so many of our parks, not just in the metro area, but across the state, really are areas that hold such cultural significance for our Indigenous communities in the state of Minnesota. The second example is with Three Rivers Park District and how they are using Legacy Funds to completely remake the Mississippi Gateway Regional Park. Located in the city of Brooklyn Park. The redevelopment of this new park is focused on introducing new visitors to the regional park system. It's located in a part of the region not well served by our regional system. It is being designed to introduce new visitors to introductory experiences with the idea that learning and skill building opportunities get progressively more advanced the deeper you move into the park. So these are just some examples. A lot of our examples in our work with Legacy Funds have really been sort of sticks and mortar type of activities of really creating new opportunities. But I also want to emphasize how many of our agencies have also use legacy funds to support programming, outreach coordinators, and really think about evolving their systems to serve new populations. So I appreciate the opportunity, and I'll turn it over to Renee Mattson to share about the Greater Minnesota's equity work.
Thanks, Lisa. Good morning, Chair Lilly.
I did the muted thing myself. Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Barajas. Ms. Mattson, go ahead, please. Sorry.
Thank you. Hey, we've all been there. The mute button is not our friend. Neither is the unmute. Good morning, Chair Lilly and committee members. I'm Renee Mattson. I am the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission. My colleagues and I are here today to talk about how each of our systems are addressing equity, diversity, and inclusion. And it's a really important subject, and I'm glad that we do have the opportunity to have the conversation and also to have the questions following at the end. The Parks and Trails Legacy Fund partners are guided by our 25-year legacy plan and the four pillars that are at the heart of that plan. But today we'll specifically address the connecting people to the outdoors pillar, which is extremely important. When the Legacy Fund began distributing the dollars back in 2009, the 25-year plan wasn't even written yet. It wasn't completed until 2011, although work was ongoing to create the plan. So as you might expect, the early focus of our legacy investments were on the capital projects, taking care of the assets already in place, investments in those areas. Those two areas did become the pillars of acquire land and take care of what we have and create opportunities, and then taking care of what we have. As we made inroads into those two areas, the necessity of the connecting people to the outdoors pillar became very urgent. We've made improvements to the facilities, so now let's vastly improve the ability of people to access our parks and trails. In Greater Minnesota, we could look to our partners at Metropolitan Council and DNR for guidance and examples of the successful initiatives that we can model. They've been doing it a lot longer than the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission broadly, and they've made meaningful investments in programming, outreach, skill building, and so rather than reinventing the wheel, we had the opportunity to learn from their efforts what worked and maybe what didn't work. So because we don't own or operate our 64 facilities, we wanted to create a way to encourage our designated facilities to do more to improve access and outreach. So last year, in an effort to do that, the commission set aside a special fund of $250,000, which is about 27% of the total grant funds available. And that was specifically to address the connecting pillar. The intent was to encourage creativity and new ideas and new initiatives, but not take away the ability for our facilities to also apply for grants for other pressing needs. And that's not to imply that people and facilities weren't already working really hard in this area. They were. There was great ideas, great programming. But this was a separate fund to support new ideas and initiatives that maybe they just didn't have the funding to be able to do. So you think of facilities managers weighing how to rehabilitate an aging asset or acquire an important piece of land adjacent, but then also how to get off the ground this great programming idea they have or an amazing skill building program. This fund set aside was to encourage them to do just those things. We didn't want to make it an either or. Do you either want to rehabilitate or do you want to do programming? Why not just make it a both proposition? So the separate fund freed our designated facilities from needing to pick one or the other. We could do both. This past year, we did have two grant applications specific to the fund. And I think, though, that the pandemic and the difficulties it presented last year just really contributed to having fewer applications than we anticipated. But we do expect to see the ideas flourish and grow over time. And just talking with our partners the past year, the ideas are bubbling to the surface, and there's great enthusiasm to be able to use these funds to do new things, to keep people engaged and accessing. So clearly the past year, we all know it was challenging, but out of these tough times, we all saw park usage increase. Lisa alluded to that. I'm sure Erica will. We did last week when we talked about it. And we've got every intention of keeping the interest in these, keeping the interest of the new users and giving them reasons to come back to continue to use our parks and trails now that they can become avid enthusiasts. And this fund that we've got set aside for Greater Minnesota is really going to contribute to that. So it's good that we can talk about this today. We're excited to be able to answer your questions specifically at the end. It's great to see that extra time. And now I'm going to turn it over to Erica Rivers, and she can talk specifically about their programming.
Thank you, Ms. Madsen, and welcome, Ms. Rivers. I know we've seen a lot of growth in the DNR. I can't believe I was over at Afton this summer one day, and it was cars piled up. And anyways, that's not why we're here to talk, but it's amazing use at the park. Yep, for all of you. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Legacy Finance Committee members. Thank you. For the record, my name is Erica Rivers. I'm Director of Minnesota Division of Parks and Trails for the Department of Natural Resources. And I want to thank you, and as well as my colleagues, for the opportunity to speak about an issue, equity in the outdoors, for which I and many of my staff in state parks and trails are so very passionate about. In the context of a heightened awareness on social justice issues in 2020, Minnesota outdoor recreation professionals, including the Parks and Trails Legacy Advisory Committee, have been compelled, really, to consider our work through a lens of equity and social justice this past year. Especially as Minnesota becomes increasingly more diverse demographically, we have to continue our efforts to connect people to the outdoors. You know, research shows that people participating in nature-based recreation benefit both mentally and physically from the exposure. And we want to make sure, as a state agency, with the DNR, that everyone has equitable opportunities to experience the benefits of our great parks and trails system across the state. As Renee Madsen and Lisa Barajas mentioned, of course, one of the primary ways we do that with legacy funding is through the Connecting People to the Outdoors pillar, which is really focused on promoting programs, education, interpretation, and all the new opportunities that we, innovative opportunities that we have to connect people to the outdoors. So of the proposed $6.5 million of legacy investment from the DNR in that Connecting People to the Outdoors pillar in fiscal 22-23, roughly one-third of that is spent specifically or invested specifically within programs and initiatives that have a focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion. I just want to spend a couple minutes here to highlight some of those signature programs, and then I'm happy to take more questions in the Q&A at the end. If we want to, delve into those a little bit further. Of course, many of you have already heard about our signature program, which is the ICANN program. This is a skill-building program that helps people who are new to the outdoors learn skills that can help them be successful in their ventures outdoors. These are designed for families to try an outdoor activity in a very low-risk, supportive environment, and we include programs with camping, fishing, paddling, and biking right now. When we advertise these programs, specifically in multicultural media resources, we have participation rates of 50% or better of people from the Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities. So this is a program that we are proud of and really do advance the work of equity in the outdoors. Another thing we're going to try this year, I think Lisa maybe mentioned this in her opening comments here, is investment in updated wayfinding and point of arrival. One of the things we recognize, especially with this new visitation that has come this year, is that people who are unfamiliar with the outdoors, one of the biggest things that they are, have some trepidation or nervousness about is, the confidence of knowing where they're going to go and how they recreate and engage in the outdoors. And so wayfinding is one of the most important confidence builders we can make investments in order to make people feel welcome and comforted when they're in the outdoors and enjoying. So we're going to make continued investments, bigger investments in that. And then just quickly, just a handful of other programs. When I mentioned that one-third of our pillar being devoted to diversity, equity, inclusion, just quickly want to tick them off. We have an urban outreach program at Fort Snelling State Park. We continue to have a focused marketing and content placement in multicultural media resources. We've been making increased investments in that over the recent years. We're going to try a social media influencer program for the first time this coming biennium, which will engage multicultural audiences in the outdoors. We will continue our work with multicultural competence building amongst DNR staff in the Division of Parks and Trails. And then finally, we also have targeted investments in mutually beneficial multicultural partnerships across all 10 of the districts across the state of Minnesota, specifically to engage new audiences in parks and trails throughout the state of Minnesota. So thank you for the opportunity to give some of these brief examples and an overview of what we're doing, and I look forward to the questions later in our time together. Thank you.
Thank you. Pretty neat story I just can't believe how much more use I've seen out there, and a lot of new faces too, which is exactly what we want to be seeing. So anyways, again, to members and everybody, please stick around. We're going to try to do questions at the end, and so we'll just kind of move on to the next group. So we're going to go into the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. And again, this isn't all inclusive of all the groups in that fund. You know, there's libraries, there's zoos, there's the Historical Society. I had a visit with them yesterday, and they're also doing a lot of great work. And we'll hear more and ask questions when they come through with their presentations. But today, we've invited Ms. Gents from the Minnesota State Arts Board, and welcome Ms. Gents. And so if you want to kind of kick off and just tell us a little bit what's going on, I know there's a ton going on in the arts and cultural area. And so anyways, Ms. Gents, welcome. Please begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. You're right. It's difficult to tell the full story in 5 or 10 minutes. So we're going to give you very high-level information today. My name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and we appreciate the chance to be part of this conversation. I know that some members already know the Arts Board, but for those who don't, very briefly, we're a state agency. Our mission is to provide financial assistance to support and promote the arts throughout the state. We're also the fiscal agent for legislatively appropriated dollars that pass through to regional arts councils. So I'll be talking a little bit about the Arts Board and its activities, and my colleague, Kathy Muchipau, will talk to you about things that are happening at the regional arts councils. So I'm going to start at a very high level and share with you our long-term goals and intended outcomes, and you have these in your handout. Shortly after the Legacy Amendment was passed, the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils developed a 25-year arts legacy framework. It's guiding how we invest dollars, and it articulates the outcomes that we're hoping to achieve. There are two key elements of that I think are especially important for this conversation. One is one of the guiding principles, the idea that there needs to be demographic and geographic fairness, and you'll find that on page 3. Every Minnesotan, no matter who they are or where they live, needs to see the benefits of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. On page 4, you'll find our goals, and one of those is that people of all ages, ethnicities, and abilities should be able to participate in the arts. That language is intentional because we know that some groups have had more access to arts experiences than others, and we need to work to address those gaps. We're making progress on our long-term goals, but we know that much work still needs to be done, and we're committed to doing that work. Secondly, I wanted to share a little information about how we make grant decisions. I think it's really important for you to understand that. The Arts Board receives and reviews approximately 1,200 grant applications a year. We award something over 600 grants a year. We recruit more than 300 individuals from across the state who bring their unique expertise and perspectives to that decision-making process. They are the ones that read the grant applications. They are the ones that decide which applications will be funded. We believe that this inclusive, citizen-driven decision-making process is one of our strengths. We're intentional when we recruit individuals. We want to see representatives of the demographic and geographic diversity of the state making decisions. And you have in your handout on page 5 statistics to date. We aren't finished for the year, but we're very pleased that 37% of the individuals who are making decisions about our grants identify as a BIPOC individual. The next thing that I wanted to do was to talk a little bit more about the outcomes of grants or what we're doing with our grant making. So we closely monitor the number of applications and grants we make to BIPOC communities. In fiscal 10, the first year of the Legacy Amendment, 12% of our grants were awarded to BIPOC individuals or organizations. This year, again, we're not finished this year, but this year, 30% of the grants have been awarded to BIPOC individuals or organizations. And I want to define that last term because I think it's important. To the Arts Board, a BIPOC organization not only serves a BIPOC community, but also is led by individuals who are of that community. The board, the staff, the leadership of the organization is representative of the community. Just before COVID hit, we also began collecting information about who participates in funded activities. That's kind of on hold now with virtual programming. It's a little harder to count participants. But we'll get back to that because we think it's important to know who is and who isn't benefiting from grants made with public funds and that we need to factor that into our grant making as we go forward. Finally, I want to spotlight some significant changes we made in our grant making this year in fiscal 21. You heard in a previous hearing from a number of our grantees who talked to you about the terrible impact that COVID-19 has had on the arts community and on their activities and organizations. In addition, the killing of George Floyd had a deep impact on the arts community, and it strengthened the resolve to work toward greater equity. In response to these two profound events, the Arts Board made two really important changes. One is that we suspended our ongoing project programs and transferred about $10 million into two brand new grant programs that are flexible to help individuals and organizations adapt to this really challenging environment and to stay connected to their communities who need their work so clearly. The other thing that we did is we looked carefully at who had and who had not been applying, and we prioritized three groups in our grant making this year. We prioritized BIPOC communities, Greater Minnesota, and individuals and organizations serving people with disabilities. I've said it before, we haven't completed our grant making for organizations yet, but we have completed our grant making for individuals, and the results have been really very promising. You have on the last page of your handout statistics and grants to individuals. In previous years, maybe 20 to 25% of the applicants identified as BIPOC, 25 to 30% of the grants went to those individuals. This year, 42% of our applications came from BIPOC individuals, and 45% of the grants have been awarded to BIPOC individuals. We're hoping to see strong progress when we complete our grant making for organizations. So with that success this year, we've decided to offer the same programs again next year. We know that COVID and the current situation will not be over on July 1st, so we'll offer those again so we can build on this progress. And I'll end by saying we've also activated a working group on our board who will be developing a process or a framework to look at the systemic barriers in our work and identify improvements for the future, and I'll be happy to come back and report on that as that work moves forward. So I will stop there and hand off to my colleague, Kathy, and I'll be looking forward to your questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jentz. Wow, that was really informative. Good morning, Ms. Muwachepo. I'm sorry, I'm so bad with names. But please, welcome to our committee, and please go ahead when you're ready. And
thank you. And that's okay. I'm totally used to that. It's not even a common Hmong last name, so everybody struggles with it. Thank you, Sue, for providing an overview of the statewide framework and goals and all the work that's being done at the State Arts Board. Hello, committee members. My name is Kathy Muwachepo. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Regional Arts Council and Vice President of the Forum of Regional Arts Councils of Minnesota. Thank you for having us here today to share our work with you. So I know, as some of you know, and maybe this will be new for you, but there are 11 regional arts councils across the state. MRAC serves the 7-county metro area. And we're primarily a grant maker, but also have provided capacity building opportunities around arts management and accessibility in the arts. The Forum is a consortium of 11 regional arts councils and serves as a place for learning, sharing, and collective work as a statewide system. So I'll be referring to both today. I've been executive director of MRAC since 2018, but have a long history as a grant applicant and recipient of the State Arts Board and MRAC, starting back in the early 2000s when I was the executive director of the Center for Hmong Arts and Talent. Coming from a culture that doesn't even have a word for art, I've come to understand the intrinsic value of the arts and how important it is to community and economic development, to strengthening communities, and the impact it has on the quality of life. We have so much to be proud of here. As the nation state with the highest per capita public investments in the arts, I believe this has a direct impact with why we also rank as one of the best states to live in. Unfortunately, we also have a terrible reputation as being one of the worst states for people of color. This Minnesota paradox, as termed by Paul Matisich of Wilder Research, is such a complex issue that it can't be solved through any one strategy or program. It requires a deeper understanding of inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility, not just as a list of things to do, but as a cultural system with very intentional practices and value that, with very intentional practices that value impact over efficiency and relationships over transactions. As a child of refugee parents, I've been an interpreter and translator for them for many years, interpreting language, cultures, and systems. I've experienced barriers and know what it feels like to try overcoming them. I learned at an early age that it's not just about working hard, but it's about having to work harder to navigate systems that didn't have you in mind when they were created. At MRAC, we're trying our best to create a system that is culturally informed and responsive to diverse needs. We recognize our responsibility to be accountable with these funds and believe that we can't do so by shoehorning marginalized communities into the very systems that make them vulnerable and disadvantaged in the first place. In 2015, when we started looking closely at the disparities in our funding and the barriers in our practices, we began a learning agenda that focused on inclusion, diversity, and equity. At that time, there was a staff of 7 with 1 person of color at part-time. Today, we have a team of 6 full-time staff with the majority that identify as people of color. And 50% of our 18-member board of directors identify as Black, Native, Asian, and Latinx. But these are really just numbers. What's important about the diversity of MRAC is that it's not easy. We've learned that to be successful in diversity means learning to adapt so you can honor different life experiences, perspectives, opinions, and approaches to the work. Failing at diversity would mean to expect everyone to participate in a monolithic manner. As we look at our funding, we saw disparities across all BIPOC communities. In fiscal year 15, about 18% of our funding went to all BIPOC communities combined. And there wasn't a single BIPOC community where we were funding proportionately with the population in the metro. Since then, we've had a steady increase each year. In fiscal year 20, 36% of our funding went to BIPOC communities, and we're seeing parity to population in most of the communities. Between FY15 and today, we've tried a number of strategies, everything from adding questions about equity in our application to creating a program specifically for groups from priority communities. And with every new strategy has come a number of lessons, failures, and successes. In fiscal year 19, we identified BIPOC, disability, LGBTQIA2+, and greater metro communities as being priorities. This was a recognition of the disparities we saw in our fundings to these communities, but also acknowledging that these communities are marginalized in all systems, including ours. We've also learned that all disparities are not equal and sometimes cannot be addressed with the same strategy. This fiscal year, we created an equity response program, and this is our response to the ongoing needs that weren't being met with small tweaks here and there in our old programs. Through this program, we've learned a lot about the barriers in our processes, and we focused on ways to be flexible and adapt our services. As I mentioned, MRAC is just one of 11 regional arts councils, and we come together as a forum. As individual regional arts councils, we're able to serve our regions with local relationships, culturally informed practices, and local sensibilities. But as a forum, we're able to work collectively and collaboratively on a more effective statewide system. The forum has also been working collectively on a learning agenda around equity since 2017. And as you can imagine, equity looks different throughout the state. And each regional arts council is at a different place in their learning and development of new practices, but we are unanimous in our commitment to ensure our funding is distributed as equitably as possible. It's through the forum that I've learned about the unique challenges and work being done in other parts of the state. For example, the Region 2 Arts Council serves 5 counties that are surrounded by 3 Native nations, White Earth, Red Lake, and Cass Lake. For the last 20 years, they've been working with an Anishinaabe Advisory Council on a number of programs. Over time, they've learned that the responsibility for ensuring equity in their programs and services should be shifted from the shoulders of the Anishinaabe Advisory Council and onto the Region 2 board and staff. oftentimes it's easy to put the responsibility of change on the communities that are being impacted, which can actually trigger more trauma. As stewards, workers within the system, and sometimes creators of systems, it is our responsibility to be listening to those communities so that we can make the appropriate decision on what needs to be changed. There are so many more examples, but what is probably most notable is the shift in the culture of the forum as it relates to equity. Addressing inequities has become a regular part of our discourse, and we recognize that there's so much more work to be done. As a state, with the legacy amendment and so much potential as a statewide system to support the arts, it is our greatest goal not to perpetuate any harm, but rather to ensure that all Minnesotans have access to this incredible resource. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Muchapau. I really enjoy your art behind you. Is that a piece that you did yourself with the mother?
Thank you. Definitely not. This is kind of the altar in my house. It's a collection of art that's been done by local artists across the state.
Well, thank you very much. Had a wonderful opportunity with Representative Wozlik last year to come and watch the grants process. And I'd been on this committee all along and I'd never seen the actual process. And it was super fascinating. So I appreciate your testimony today. And having seen it, the questions were thorough. And much of what you spoke about is true and going on in action. Thank you very much. Both of you. Please stick around, and then we're going to move on to the next grouping, to the Clean Water Area of the Fund. And I think we're going to start off with Mr. Gardner, Administrator for the Clean Water Council. Mr. Gardner, I see your screen, but I don't see you. But go ahead and introduce yourself when you're ready, and thank you for coming. Paul here. Oh, there he is.
Yep. Sorry, I had to turn one thing off. And you'd think after all this time we'd get started. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council. The Clean Water Council recommends how to spend the Clean Water Fund, which is one third of the revenue from the legacy amendment. My slides are brief here, but most of the details for the Clean Water Fund will be covered by Assistant Commissioner Kessler from the PCA, who will talk about agency-wide activities on the Clean Water Fund that will tell you about the intersection of equity and clean water. I wanted to mention first that our first strategic plan for the Clean Water Council was approved last March. In that list of strategies for where we're going to be between now and 2034 when the amendment expires is the development of a diversity, equity, and inclusion plan sometime in 2021. But I will confess, like a lot of entities in the United States who have thought about this issue, we didn't really know how to go about it. And we wanted it to be an authentic effort. The events of last May in Minneapolis, I think, made so many of us laser focused on our own failings in not doing anything on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so we have been accelerating our efforts and going through a period of self-reflection. We have reached out to all four ethnic councils in the state. We're an advisory council, just like their advisory councils. We had a conversation with several. I'm waiting to hear back from another. But that's led to some good conversations. We've also reached out with different organizations I'll mention in a minute. I do want to mention that in our fiscal 22 and 23 Clean Water Fund recommendations, there are two items I just wanted to highlight. They'll be coming to you soon. One is that we have introduced the idea of a small grants program. This is modeled on the Conservation Partners Legacy Program that the Outdoor Heritage Fund uses. But we're asking for a small amount this time around to pilot some ideas, particularly for organizations that have not been able to access the Clean Water Fund before because they might not have been a water-related local government entity, for example. We're not exactly sure what that would look like, but we're very interested in hearing from entities that would like to find about equitable access and they may have been square pegs and round holes because of the way we did eligibility for grant programs before. I also wanted to highlight some research from the Humphrey Institute at the University of Minnesota, which is planning to explore whether our water investments are in fact equitable at a variety of levels. And so we hope we'll have favorable consideration for that request. The council has also been taking stock of past efforts and asking agencies what they've done in this area. And Ms. Kessler has a very comprehensive presentation on that. One thing that folks like myself have had to do in the last year is really do the work of understanding the historical context, particularly as it relates to Black, Indigenous, and people of color in Minnesota. BIPOC communities are dealing with a lot right now, and so it really helps if we do our homework ahead of time before we burden people with another conversation. But we were really interested in looking for where we have gaps and opportunities in using the Clean Water Fund as part of the legacy amendment in the future. I did want to mention a couple of areas where we have been doing our homework just so you can get a flavor of what we are learning at a strategic level as the Clean Water Council. And this is just the one slide. So we've heard from the Water Main Initiative at American Public Media. They have national survey results that are quite enlightening about what people know about their water and how to protect it. And statistically significant findings include that BIPOC communities are more interested in learning about water and how to protect it than white respondents. They are African-American communities in particular are more interested in seeing government do more to protect supplies of water. I have a feeling that may be related to the aftermath of the Flint, Michigan situation. We also heard from the University of Minnesota and the nonprofit Renewing the Countryside about women in agriculture. 10% of farmers are women, but women own a lot more than 10% of Minnesota farmland. They own more than 4 million acres. They are key stakeholders in deciding whether or not to employ best practices that improve water quality, such as conservation tillage and cover crops. And surveys that we've heard about say that women are actually more receptive than men to adopting these practices, but because of a variety of reasons, they feel ignored, dismissed, and are rebuffed from trying those things and end up sticking with the status quo. We also heard from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Governor Waltz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan issued Executive Order 1924 on government-to-government relationships between the state and Minnesota's tribal governments. All of the agencies that receive clean water funds are required to comply with that executive order, which includes requirements for consultation. We did hear about the importance of consultation, but we also heard about historical context of what happens when you don't have consultation. And the chair of the Prairie Island Indian community told us of those historical examples, such as having a nuclear power plant situated next door and having a federal dam during the 30s, I believe, that backed up water over a considerable part of their land. I also had the chance to take state tribal relations training, which is the best training class I've ever taken. Finally, we also heard from a state employee who actually owns a family farm in Alabama. He is one of only 45,000 African-American farmers in the United States. We spend a lot of the Clean Water Fund in helping educate, train, or persuade farmers to use best practices to improve water quality, and it really helps to import to know whether those kinds of efforts have worked in the past. And what we discovered from this presentation is that over the course of many decades, especially in the South, the USDA, through its local offices, systematically discriminated against African-American farmers in their efforts to get technical and financial assistance. That is one factor why the percentage of farmers who are African-American has dropped from 14% in 1920 to 2% today. And that has been a direct contributor to the lack of intergenerational transfer of wealth, which also translates into places like northern cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul, where home ownership rates and the level of wealth in African-American communities are lower. So that was helpful context to understand where we've been. We have more of that learning on the way. We are very open at the Clean Water Council to hearing from other communities. Ms. Kessler is going to talk particularly about some projects intersecting with the immigrant communities. But we'd love to hear from you, and we thank you for having this discussion, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Kessler.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Thank you for joining us, and that was great. Let's see, I'm losing you. There you are on the screen. Sorry, Assistant Commissioner Kessler, good morning. Thank you. I know you're speaking for a lot of different groups, but I know you can handle it. Okay.
Good morning, Chair Lilly and members of the committee. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you for the opportunity to come back to the committee. I'm here again on behalf of the Clean Water Fund agency partners. So this includes the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Health, the Department of Ag, the Department of Natural Resources, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Public Facilities Authority, and the Met Council Environmental Services. To follow up on how we are engaging with diverse populations and striving to make sure that all voices are represented. Before I walk through some examples, I want to say that at a high level, our ability to engage with Minnesotans in the Twin Cities and in greater Minnesota is foundational to achieving our collective success, both fishable, swimmable, and drinkable waters. We know that disparities exist across the state and that communities of color are more likely to pay a higher percentage of their income for water and wastewater services. And we know that communities of color do not have the same access to water for recreation. The agencies tasked with leading and partnering with others to implement the clean water work recognize that historically we have not always engaged well with communities beyond the traditional audience. And our historic practices of holding public meetings in locations and in languages like English exclusively may not work for our target communities where we need to be doing the work to be successful. So we are working hard to improve, to listen, to hear the stories and to find commonalities and build a bigger and more diverse coalition that is necessary to really be successful. So diversity, inclusion, and equity are core to the work of our respective agencies. For example, it's integrated into the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's five-year strategic plan, which charts our agency's direction for 2022. That plan is highlighted on the screen, includes goals and measures for our primary areas of work. And to make progress on the goals, we regularly track measures in each of these areas. So I want to call your attention to the cross-agency measure, which is to the first one up there, it's hard to see, is to incorporate strategies to address environmental justice concerns in all of our programs. And one of the measures we're tracking, which I've highlighted here, is to ensure that there are no disproportionate impacts between environmental justice areas and other areas. So in the water arena, we measure and evaluate data collected and analyzed in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Health using Clean Water Fund dollars. And we are looking at whether or not we have consistent water quality trends across the state as compared to areas where we have higher environmental justice proportionality. So the map on the right displays mercury fish concentrations by major watershed. So this is an average of all species collected from 1998 through 2017. And each lake in that watershed is then averaged overall for a greater mean. And that's overlaid by environmental justice areas. So the darker the colors on the map, so the reds and orange have the highest percentage of environmental justice communities, and the larger the dots show higher percentage of mercury in fish. So a large number of Minnesota families, a significant portion of which are BIPOC, rely on fish harvested from our lakes and rivers as a food source. And knowledge about fish consumption advisories can help people make informed and safe decisions for their families. And following consumption advice is particularly important for pregnant and young women and children who are most vulnerable to the health impacts. And we know that this is important, particularly for Minnesota's Native American population and other communities of color that practice subsistence fishing. So this is one example how we are using our water data, our fish data, to look at whether or not there are disproportionate impacts across the state. So in the remainder of my slides, I'm going to show some examples of how we are focusing our clean water implementation dollars on improving or minimizing disproportionate impacts. So We Are Water is a Clean Water Fund rotating exhibit focused on building relationships among many different people who call Minnesota home to create shared understandings of the issues we face and to build relationships from which to solve problems. State agencies and local hosts receive engagement training and practice building relationships with people and organizations that are different from themselves and underrepresented overall in our work. The program is a collaboration between the Minnesota Humanities Center, the MPCA, the Minnesota Historical Society, the Department of Health, the Department of Natural Resources, and other state agencies. Local hosts develop the exhibit in partnership with their community to highlight local water issues. So currently, if you haven't seen it, the We Are Water exhibit is at the Hmong Museum, a nonprofit in St. Paul. State agencies worked with the host to create an outdoor version of the exhibit. So this is a COVID-friendly space in response to pandemic safety concerns. And the walkthrough digitally interactive event is located at the Hmong American Partnership Little Mekong Plaza, and it's going to be there through March 8th. So sometimes We Are Water is hosted by BIPOC-led organizations like the Hmong Museum. Another example is the Fond du Lac Natural Resource Center, which hosted in 2019. Other hosts have been traditionally white-led organizations, but I think overall the take-home is that we are trying to wherever the space is, to look to seek input from communities who have been traditionally or historically left out of the narrative. So since 2016, We Are Water has visited 19 communities, involved 379 organizations, reached 49,000 visitors, and strengthened six state agencies' relationships with each other and local partners to do meaningful community engagement. This slide highlights Met Council Environmental Services work to bring water suppliers and customers together to share perspectives on water use and the value of water and provide efficiency grants to equitably address water needs in single family homes, thinking about outdoor watering, and multifamily homes, thinking about indoor water use to overall improve the economic equity. Example recent grants include New Brighton, who replaced toilets in old apartment complexes, and in Woodbury, where they replaced irrigation controllers. To better understand and represent the diverse values of the residents in the region, Met Council is also working with the University of Minnesota to assess residents' perceptions and values for water and how they vary across communities, particularly in BIPOC communities and in culturally diverse areas of the Twin Cities community. This work is ongoing and will identify opportunities for enhanced communication and engagement around our water systems, benefits and stressors, and it will also help prioritize community-centered action steps for equitable water planning and policy. The outcomes of the study will guide future Clean Water Fund spending for the Met Council, and we share these learnings across the agency, so we're hoping to learn as well. The tragedy of lead poisoning through drinking water in Flint, Michigan, raised all of our awareness of this invisible threat. The unfortunate facts surrounding lead poisoning are that residents in housing with lead service lines are expected to be exposed to more lead in their drinking water than those without lead service lines. Low-income and minority residents are more likely to live in older housing, and older housing stock is more likely to have lead service lines. So we have this trifecta where the disproportionate impacts fall on low-income communities of color. They're more likely to be experience high levels of exposure to lead from their drinking water. And we know this group is more likely to rent than to own the properties they reside in, so they have fewer levers and less power to change the infrastructure in their structure. The Clean Water Council recommended that the legislature appropriated funding for the University of Minnesota and the Department of Health to identify ways to get the lead out of drinking water, propose interventions, and conduct a cost-benefit analysis of lead removal options. That report found that removing lead service lines provides at least $2 in benefits for every dollar of cost removal. And I'll just highlight, and there are people here from the Department of Health who can answer questions, that in January 2021, so just last month, the federal government revised the lead and copper water quality standard that applies to drinking water. And they've highlighted on the slide are three areas of that slide. So they're looking at who is affected, how to increase awareness and transparency of this issue, and how to protect our most vulnerable water customers. Protection of drinking water using clean water funds spans beyond lead service lines. As noted here, clean water fund monies are also used to assist the million plus Minnesotans who use private wells and do not have the same public health protection as those who are served by a community water supply. In most cases, if you have a private well, after one initial water test that looks at bacteria, nitrate, and arsenic, you're on your own for periodic testing, operation, and maintenance. Clean water, and in particular, clean drinking water, we know, again, is an equity issue. All people in Minnesota have the right to clean and safe drinking water. And a well owner's capacity to manage these steps is closely related to their education and income. And regulatorily, there are fewer health protections for private well users. Further inequity happens when a well owner must pay for the cost of treatment for contamination that they did not cause, such as if you find out in your instance that your well is contaminated by nitrate, you know, you have very little recourse at this point. The Department of Health Private Well Protection Initiative provides grants for safe drinking water for private well owners aimed at areas with elevated nitrate or areas with elevated arsenic. The grant funds help pay for well testing, education, financial assistance, install treatment systems, and grants are given in consideration of equity and diversity. In complementary activities, the Department of Agriculture uses clean water funds to assist private well owners with expensive pesticide monitoring as well as nitrate monitoring. Their monitoring is targeted in areas which are highly vulnerable to groundwater contamination. And in addition to offering free samples and analysis to every homeowner, the MDA also conducts a follow-up inspection with a qualified professional to give advice to homeowners if their well is substandard and provides assistance as to what next steps might be feasible. Okay, this is the last couple slides here. A strategic partnership with the Department of Natural Resources, the Conservation Corps, and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The IDEC program is a collaborative that intends to reduce barriers and eliminate raise the percentage of underrepresented students in STEM degrees and overall obtaining environmental careers, hopefully, at state agencies and with our partners. The benefits to participants include a stipend, hands-on experience through paid annual summer internships, firsthand insight to learn about environmental natural resources career, professional and personal development, and skills and abilities necessary to become a competitive job applicant. And I can tell you, as someone who has served as a mentor for one of these students, that I have learned more from my mentee than I think I could think that he has learned from me. So I can't say enough about this really excellent program. And the final example is a Board of Water and Soil Resources 2017 grant to the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization to install stormwater best management practices on highly impervious urban properties. The project included an outreach to gain interest from properties around the targeted area of Central and Lowry Avenues in Northeast Minneapolis. And turns out the Islamic Cultural Community Center proved to be an ideal site and a willing participant for the grant, as it was a large standalone building with areas that could easily be transformed into infiltration basins. The project also had a great outreach, being a cultural space in the heart of Northeast Minneapolis. The Mississippi Watershed Management Organization worked with the Cultural Center as well as Metro Blooms to redesign and reconstruct their parking lot with landscape features that capture and treat polluted runoff. And it's noted that in addition to managing stormwater runoff, the improvements make the building more welcoming and accessible, so overall a win-win. So, Mr. Chair, thank you again for the opportunity to be here. On behalf of the partners on the slide, there are representatives today from all of these agencies, and we're happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Really enjoyed the jobs part there at the end. I had clipped this out of the paper. I was going to give it to Representative Zhang, but it's exactly the thing that you were talking about at the traveling exhibit, and it was covered in the local paper, Pioneer Press here. So anyways, thank you. Please stick around if you can, and appreciate it. And Mr. Gardner as well. Mr. Johnson, we're hoping things are moving pretty quick. We still want to leave a lot of time for questions, so I don't know if you can compress a little, but you have a lot of good work, I hope, going on out there too, and so we want to hear that. So go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We'll get right into it here, and I'll move it quickly along. Members, for the record, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. And I'll try to give you a little bit of an overview of the Outdoor Heritage Council as it relates to distribution of funds and how that goes equitably across the state. As we're looking at, I gotta get this page, there we go. The Outdoor Heritage Fund, of course, it's one-third of the constitutionally dedicated legacy funds from the sales tax dollars. But statutory guidance comes from 97A.056, and that statutory guidance called for a formation of a council to oversee recommendations of the funds as well as the practice of the distribution of those funds. And that ended up being the Lasard Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. It's part of the legislature, or part of the legislative branch by as it's defined by statute. And it makes funding recommendations, and then the legislature then appropriates. But all of the funds from the Outdoor Heritage Fund in statute are to be directly related, for their use to be directly related to restoration, protection, enhancement of wetlands, prairies, forests, habitats for fish, game, and wildlife, plus to protect or prevent forest fragmentation and encourage forest consolidation and then expand native prairie, expand restored native prairie. Statute also called for another thing, and that was a small grants program to be developed, and the council developed that. It's called the CPL, or Conservation Partner Legacy Program, and I'll tell you more about that in a little bit here. The current membership of the council, the council is made up of 12 people, 8 of them are citizens and 4 are legislators, and here's the current distribution of the council as it stands. You can see that there are 4 legislators, 2 representatives, 2 senators, and they are one from each party. In the House and in the Senate. You can see that in the House, we have Representative Jamie Becker Finn. Representative Fabian retired, so we're right now waiting for a replacement for him to serve on the council. We just received Dudley Edmondson as an appointee. We're excited about that. He's from Duluth, and I think he's going to be a wonderful addition to the council. And also Kristen Eggerling is over in northwestern Minnesota up at Hallock. Those are from the House. The Senate and the governor, you can see there, I won't name them all off, but you can also see that 2 of the governor appointees are up for reappointment or replacement. So we're also waiting for those this month. But the distribution of the council, you know, is an interesting thing. And I tried to put together a screen here to show you where they come from across the state. And as you look at the stars are from the House, the triangles from the Senate, of course, and then the hexagons are from the governor's office. But half of the council comes right now is representing right here from the metro area. And that's with citizens as well as legislators. So that's kind of interesting to see the geographic distribution. We do have outstate members, which is good, but half of it is right here from the metro. The council's job is to review proposals for funding from people who want to receive money for funding, and also to watch and see how does that money go to use. There are several different lenses the council uses for looking at that. Racial boundaries aren't one of those. It's we're looking at habitat. And so what we look at is, what's the accountability? Is there transparency? Is there leveraged funds? Are they conservation focused? Are they science based? And it also is all competitive process. So really the another thing is, another way to put it is, the projects are weighed on their merits for the immediacy of need, the capacity of the organization. Is it a rational proposal? Is it really something that can do good and make sense? And then what are the costs and leverage that are provided, and how much community involvement is there? So they, and the council also has to look at it all through ecological sections, which is, you know, looking at the entire state and how those funds should be distributed. And here are those ecological sections. Every one of the sections has its own outcomes, but in a nutshell, it really comes down to several different common criteria, such as are they going to keep the water on the land? Are they going to produce healthy native plant communities and healthy native wildlife communities? As well as, are they going to produce good habitat? Because that's really what we're defined to do by statute and by constitution. Are there pressing needs? What's the return on investment? And of course, over the last 12 years, there's been about $1.2 billion that has been allocated by the legislature from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. There's been another $460 million in leverage from state, federal, private organizations. And of that $1.2 billion, about $91 million has gone to the CPL in small grants portion, which in itself has leveraged another $11 million or more, plus getting all kinds of people involved. From a geographic standpoint, that there's been over 1 million acres already restored, enhanced, or protected across the state with Outdoor Heritage Funds. And the small grants portion, that's done 275,000, so with 800 different grants. Lots of different activities, for everything from, well, you can see a list there, but there's lots more. The CPL, or the small grants program, is grants under $400,000. And then the council looks at the larger grants of over $400,000. So just the CPL projects have already affected or been placed in 96% of the counties across the state. There are four counties that haven't had CPL projects yet, and that's it. So from an equity of distribution geographically, the funds are getting out there. 25 million, so over, 91 million have been appropriated to CPL. 25 million of that has gone to the metro urbanizing areas alone across the state. And those areas are, of course, primarily the metro here, Twin Cities Metro, but also St. Cloud, Duluth, and Rochester. If we take just this seven county metro, the CPL projects alone, you see dots here. The stars are actually acquisitions, which there's only a few. And the green dots are restorations, and the red dots are enhancements. Interesting with this is, it shows the distribution of projects here across the metro, but this doesn't include the last 2 years. So there's at least another 20 more dots to go on this map. If we look at it a little differently with the same basic area, pardon me, a little different scale map, I just couldn't get it quite the same way. But this one is, as of last December, looking at overall the small grants and the large grants in the metro area, where are they, how many are located in this metro? And if you look at, can you see my cursor here, Mr. Chair? Yes, okay.
Yes.
If you look at these dots, now here's one that says ML 2010, that's Minnesota Laws of 2010, it's an individual appropriation. But next to it, we see one that says five. That means that under that balloon, there are five more projects. And underneath this one, there are 10 appropriations and 14 appropriations and so on. So if you go on our website, and I'll show you that in a little bit, you can actually ferret down into those and actually see what's going on. See the individual projects. From a statewide basis, this is how the projects distribute across the state. And I'm going to back up three. This map shows the distribution of CPL projects across the state. So you can see they really, really have gone the gamut across the state. If we look at this next one, this is a distribution of all of the grants across the state, all the appropriations and projects. So
Mr. Johnson, I'm going to have you kind of wrap up pretty quick because I want to make sure I get to questions. Because
I think I've got one more slide and that's it, sir.
Okay,
and
sorry to be.
No, that's fine. Here's my last slide. It's just, if you go on our website, you'll find a map on the left side of our website that has all of it. You can click on that, you can ferret or dig down into any project in any area of the state you want. You can even look at your district and see what's in your district or what's next to your district. So the last thing I should close with is I'd really like to make an invitation to each of your members, Mr. Chair, that if you have anybody in your district who's interested in applying for Outdoor Heritage Funds, I'd love to work with them. I'd love to help them to try to figure out what's possible. Our staff is always open to that. We try to put the invitation out as much as we can because the more word we can spread, the more projects that are going to happen. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, and thank you for your presentation. I know that if any members or the public does call down to your office, that you're always eager to respond and very helpful. So I want to get to questions. Again, you know, we have 20 minutes. So is there a way that we could maybe just kind of ask each member going through the list, starting with Representative Jordan, and then kind of just do one question, and then we'll come back. You know, hopefully we can get to as many members as we can. And then we'll just do one question and then kind of move on to the next. Again, thank you all the presenters. And Representative Vice Chair Jordan, go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Ms. Kessler, and it's about lead service lines. So I know last year I had a bill to replace both the publicly owned and privately owned portions of the lead service line. So I'm wondering how replacement efforts have been going. I know there have been a number of challenges this year. And I was also just wondering if you could comment on if you have the access to research, science, and resources you need to really address environmental health concerns, particularly in BIPOC communities. So love to just hear your thoughts on the lead service line issue, and then just generally if you have the resources you need to actually achieve your environmental justice mission.
Commissioner Kessler?
Chair Lilly and member, this is an excellent question, and I will answer the second part of the question, then I'll ask my colleague from the Minnesota Health Department, who is in the Zoom room, Tani Eschenhauer, to speak to the lead service line question. So I think generally we always would like to be able to do more and do more faster. I think that the challenges and the historic racism that is embedded in our regulatory schemes make it frustrating at this moment in time to not be able to work faster. That said, the environmental changes that have occurred in the last 100 years in terms of impacts and pollution have not occurred overnight. So I think it's important that we be persistently impatient and pushing to be faster. One area in the Clean Water Fund specifically is our program of contaminants of emerging concern that the MPCA administers with the Department of Health. So perhaps Ms. Eschenhauer would like to comment on that too. We're looking at new and emerging contaminants that impact communities and have the potential to impact drinking water systems. The fish contaminant monitoring that the fund uses money for that was highlighted in the mercury slide. That's another area where we're looking at environmental justice. So I think we have a good foundation. I think if the whole pie were to increase and we could do more, that would be great. But I don't know that we can borrow from somebody else to say we want to accelerate in this area, because I think we're all working towards environmental justice ends in our own area. So that's a long way of saying I think we're on the right path. If more money came to us, I think we would appreciate that, but we recognize that there's just as many other really important needs out there. So I'm going to defer now to Ms. Eschenhauer on the specific lead service line question.
Go ahead, sir. I'm sorry. My screen was glaring. I'm sorry. Good morning. Yeah, please state your name and answer the question, please. And then be quick because we want to get on to, sorry to be pushing everybody.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tani Eschenauer, and I'm Water Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Health. And as part of our mission to protect the health of all Minnesotans, we are very interested in the issue of lead service lines, and particularly the new strategies that are part of the federal revision of the lead and copper rule. That's how we manage risks from lead in drinking water in the state. And one of the new provisions that we have is that there's been a change in language so that we are able to offer grants to community water supplies through our collaborative work with the Public Facilities Authority that will allow community water supplies to better finance the replacement of these lead service lines. As you're aware, in many cities, the ownership is shared between the city and the resident. And so this is a financial challenge. And so this change allows us to address that. One area which we are looking at to provide resources for is supporting these cities in identifying how many lead service lines. We have some estimates based on housing stock age, but we don't know exactly how many lead service lines are in each of our community water systems. And so this is the first area, the first step that we need to work on. And one provision of the new rule is that lines that are unknown at this time have to be counted as lead service lines. So we have 3 years to begin implementation of this rule. And so we will be working very hard to support our community water systems as they incorporate these new required actions into their activities.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure we can follow up with more questions later. Representative Acomb, and again, my apologies to everybody. I don't know what I do wrong here, but we're just trying to compress. I think I've got to go into an evening meetings or something here so we could do phase two. Representative Acomb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My question is for Mr. Johnson with the Outdoor Heritage Council. And I really appreciated all the presentations by all of our presenters today and really the examples that were given of outreach within our communities of color throughout the state. And I really just wanted to circle back to Mr. Johnson's presentation. And while he showed some diversity of geography throughout the state, I didn't necessarily hear about any intentional efforts with engagements and engagement with our communities of color. So I just wanted to circle back and see if maybe you could provide some opportunity or some examples of that. And if not, I really want to challenge you, especially given that there's a third of the legacy funds that go into this outdoor heritage account that those efforts be considered and amplified. So would love to hear if there are specific things that you are doing and maybe just didn't provide in your presentation.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Member Acomb, no, there are not, I can't say that the council specifically reaches out to communities of color. The council reaches out to you know, puts out a call for funding requests each year, and that goes out to everybody. The interesting thing is there aren't a lot of contractors. Let's back up. We receive a lot of applications from agencies, from local government units, and from nonprofit agencies for outdoor heritage funds. Those nonprofit agencies aren't made up of just individuals of color, and neither are the agencies or local units of government. But those are the recipients, you know, who has to be by law. You can, any nonprofit could come in and ask for funds, but it has to be habitat related. And I'd love to have a community of color or a nonprofit that is run for a community of color to ask for funds for habitat work. So far, I can't say that has happened. Now, I don't know all of the Conservation Partner Legacy grants, the small grants. Those are much more oriented to local groups in the metro areas. And it may be if we had Kathy Varble, the coordinator for CPL, to come before the council sometime. It may be that there are individual projects that have been granted that way. But as far as the larger council and looking at grants of $400,000 or greater, those are generally programmatic and they stretch over larger geographic areas. So I'm sorry I can't give you some wonderful examples. I wish I really had them, but we try to everything we can to reach out as much as we can, including through social media.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'm sure there'll be follow-up on that. I do know from experience that you did do some work with Native Nations. But we can talk about that more in the
You're correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
I'm here.
Okay, good. Fox chicken.
I know. I didn't think I was going to get up here today. First of all, just real quick, I think that in Legacy we have more tangible examples of equity and diversity than probably anywhere else. We promote the outdoors, water culture to all Minnesotans. BIPOC communities have been targeted in some instances. I could mention the immersion language program, and basically Legacy has helped to save the Dakota and Anishinaabe languages. Graves and the native projects with those. We funded councils. I'd just like to ask Ms. Jens, does she have a certain percentage? I noticed that it was near 50% with some of these projects going to BIPOC. Do they have a percentage that they set as they're beginning their process for the BIPOC community?
Ms. Jens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Erdahl, for that question. We don't set percentages or quotas. What we have always wanted to track is to make sure that BIPOC communities, Greater Minnesota, others are at or above parity with their percentage of population in the state. And so that's why the numbers that we're seeing at this moment are especially promising. But I'm happy to follow up. I know time is tight. I'm happy to follow up more with you on that question if you'd like.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you both. Representative Green.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. I appreciate this this time. I have such a series of questions. And so one of the things I'd like to say is, as we move forward with the, and I can ask these questions as these things come up in committee, but maybe schedule your committees not so tight, because there's a lot of information that I'd like to see, not only for myself, but for everyone else as well. And I know the other committees are getting really balled up with the Zoom meetings as well. So maybe we could stretch out these meetings a little more by not having quite so many people in them. But
again, my apologies, Representative Green. I'm so sorry. I really am trying to figure it out.
I understand, but I'm finding this in every committee. But the other thing, I'll just ask the one question then, and this is Mr. Johnson. Does he have right on hand for the committee? I mean, I have a lot of the information, but for the committee, there were a lot of proposals that came up for enhancements and restoration that didn't get funded. And as a general rule, you can do many, many times more acres of enhancement and restoration than you can land acquisition. So do you have a total of what the acres would have been if we had spent the money that you're using for land acquisition on restoration and enhancement?
Mr. Johnson and Representative Green, we're going to have Mr. Johnson back, and we're going to have plenty of opportunity to dig into the Lessard Sams itself. Do you have any equity questions this morning for us?
Well, on the equity questions, I was listening to a lot of the testifiers, and it looks like in the arts and cultural heritage, they're actually doing a pretty good job of that. As far as the Outdoor Heritage Fund, I do know that it doesn't really matter who you are. If you meet the criteria, you can apply for the grants. So I don't think that there's any this is one thing about Legacy. I don't think there's anything in there that I've ever seen that omits the BIPOC folks from coming in and applying. And so I guess I would like to see instances that if people have complaints on that, because it doesn't look like it seems to be a problem in this committee anyway.
Thank you, Representative Green. And, I'm glad we're having a discussion, and I hope that we can continue having it throughout the session. Representative Jung, and hopefully we can get Representative Anderson in too, if anybody else. Again, my apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank all of our presenters for sharing with us what they have been doing to be more inclusive of our communities who are not often at the table. But I want to share that I am a bit conflicted because I have been hearing different stories from the community, especially from our BIPOC communities. And the stories are night and day. And so I just want to say that I am paying attention, and I know that the community is watching today, and I want the community to know that I'm still here and I'm listening to you all, and I will be taking the necessary actions needed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jung. And, I think we all can do better, but we're hearing some good stories, but I think, we all hear from different folks, and I'm quite sure that you're right, that there are areas we can improve. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question for Renee Manson, if she's still online with us. Greater Minnesota Trails and Parks, and talking about connectivity. Out in my area, we have a couple of trails that maybe are 4 or 5 miles long, and then they end, and then there's another trail maybe 5 miles down the road that picks up the trail again. And when you talk about connectivity, are you meaning that there could be some assistance financially to help connect all these trails and make one longer trail instead of all of our out in my area trails that are short and broken up? Is there help available for that?
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I don't know. Do you have anything that's maybe focused on equity? We're going to have these folks back. Not that I don't want to hear from Ms. Matson. She has a great story to tell. I'm hoping that we can kind of focus in our last few seconds here on
equity. No, go ahead, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that.
No. Please, I know she'll respond, and we're going to have them back too. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to ask another question. My question was really for all the groups, and I know we're really short on time here, but I'm hoping when they come back, they can talk a lot about staffing, particularly what each of the funds is doing to both recruit and retain diverse staff. I think this is an incredibly important part of the equation for being able to serve multiple communities, is being able to have representatives of those communities working within your staff. We know that there's both recruitment and really a retention issue across Minnesota. So I'm hoping the various funds can talk a little bit about staffing, recruitment, and retention.
Excuse me, can anybody want to jump on that? And I see one more question from Representative Bo as well. So,
Mr. Chair, this is Erica Rivers from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Go ahead, Ms. Rivers, sorry.
My pleasure. I think this was mentioned in the Clean Water Fund, but there is a program called IDEC, Increasing Diversity in Environmental Careers, which uses a wonderful partnership with our Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa. And it is exclusively to try to bring in people of color in diverse communities into environmental careers. This is a cooperative project between Minnesota DNR, Bowser, and PCA. It is in its first year. Last year, we are starting the second year now. It's a very exciting program. We've had opportunity to interface with many of these young, bright, enthusiastic individuals. And I can say that the future, if we continue to see what we see in this first year, the future is very bright for increasing diversity in outdoor recreation and environmental careers.
Thank you, Ms. Rivers. And again, with the pushing up on the clock, hopefully, as people come forward in these discussions and come back, maybe Ms. Kessler, do you have a quick, you're looking like you're kind of jumping.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll just add to what Ms. Rivers said. we at the MPCA know that other agencies are doing this too, are tracking and have goals. There are goals across the state agencies to recruit and retain participants and employees of color. And so we are doing things in addition to IDEC to retain employees that we could come back separately or follow up with if there's an interest.
Thank you. Representative Boak, can you please put your question on the table here? And sorry about that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can do that. I assume we'll have other opportunities.
Yes, sir.
Very good.
No, can you throw out your question quick?
Oh, good. I thought you said table. Okay. You know, we've heard a lot of positive talk about positive impacts and trends, and that's a good thing. But a quick question for Ms. Kessler. She said something to the effect of, we know that communities of color have less access to waters for recreation, something to that effect. And I'll be honest, I don't know that. And so I was kind of wondering where that came from and what she meant by that.
Ms. Kessler.
Chair Lilly and others, I'll just say that in my previous life, I was the director of the Surface Water and Sewers Division within the city of Minneapolis. And there was a lot of discussion of how we could work with the transportation planners in the city to bring transit routes to lakes, streams, and creeks where somebody could get to if they didn't have a car. So in that instance, in my example, we knew that it was very car dependent, and the income level that someone had does determine whether or not they can get in a car and drive to a skate park or drive to a lake or a cabin.
Thank you very much, everyone, this morning. Again, my apologies with the clock. I don't know. Anyways, we'll try to do better. But please know that these conversations are, we expect that they continue. And I'm glad that people are listening and hearing the story. There's so many good stories to hear already, but we can clearly do better. But everybody, I very much appreciate the discussion this morning and look forward to meeting with all of you as we continue forward. Thank you, everyone. With that, we are adjourned.